Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I'm feeling much better than I did last week. I don't know how you found it, guys, but it's quite bleak. Oh God, here we go. But actually, weirdly, it's all autumnal now, and it's, well, to put it politely, it's pissing it down. And I don't know, maybe I've just got used to it. Maybe my London brain is like, yeah, that's normal life, it's just rain. Anyway, I hope wherever you are listening, you're doing okay. Thank you so much for listening to the Griefcast. Thank you so much for your amazing comments on this new series. I've been overwhelmed, just astonished at how lovely and all the incredible messages that you've been sending. So thank you so much. As ever, we are on Twitter and Instagram at the Griefcast if you'd like to join in the chat. This week, I'm talking to writer and former barrister Olivia Potts. Olivia is the author of A Half-Baked Idea. She is just a brilliant, brilliant human, and I thoroughly recommend following her on Instagram at A Half-Baked Idea, because she regularly posts things she's cooked and recipes which might help you get through these winter months. Olivia came in to talk to me about her mum. Every time I do a Griefcast, I panic about someone's name. And now I'm worried I said your name wrong.
No, you said my name right. No, bang on.
Do you know what's happened is, in my head, the whole time that I've known you and be aware of you, I've been saying Poots. Olivia Poots.
Because that's my handle on Twitter. That's fair.
Oh, that's why.
That's why,
and then
yeah.
Today I had to email you and I was like, oh my God, her name's Potts. Cariad, why have you been making her into this cutie little...
No, it's an old nickname from uni.
Okay.
So Poots is my handle, but Potts is my
I'm glad
surname.
That you've... I thought I'd just...
You're not
weird.
Just getting mad.
And Livia, as I said, is a writer. You recently wrote an incredible memoir called A Half-Baked Idea, which just won the Fortnum & Mason's Debut Food Writing Award.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That must have been very exciting.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, it's hard writing any book. I have a lot of respect for anyone who just gets to the end of 80 or 90,000 words.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's quite exposing writing a memoir about death and grief and parents.
Yeah.
So it was very nice, particularly nice for it to win that.
Did you get any free stuff from Fortnum & Mason's?
you may get a large hamper.
Oh my God. Guys, it's worth writing a book just for that alone. That is so exciting.
Honestly, the most exciting thing when that's delivered. I haven't got my trophy yet because of lockdown, but
oh, yes,
do I
course.
Even need it if I've got a giant Fortnum's hamper?
No.
Probably not.
A whole hamper, that's incredible.
Yeah. A lot of biscuits.
Oh
a
yeah,
lot,
they love the biscuits.
A lot of biscuits.
I hope there's some marmalade in there as well.
Do you know, there was no marmalade. There was jam. There was no marmalade, but there was jam.
I don't want to be shady, but I did actually buy some Fortnum & Mason's marmalade because my husband loves... I don't like marmalade. And he was actually a bit like, meh, about it.
Well, so The Fortnum's Marmalade I'd recommend is that they stock the stuff that wins the World's Original Marmalade Awards. So I'm sure the Fortnum standard stuff is great, but you can get like the best in the world.
Oh, wow.
Because they're the only place that stock it. And it is very good.
Okay, now I'm...
That's my marmalade tip.
That's good. Guys, if I could do a podcast about marmalade, I mean, I wouldn't. My husband would have to do it, but I'm happy to talk food. Anyway, so... Obviously, this isn't the Marmalade cast. Are we remembering today, Olivia?
We are remembering my mum, Ruth.
Ruth? Oh, yeah. My mum's called Ruth. So Ruth Potts.
Yes.
And so how long ago did Ruth die?
So I always feel really bad about this because I forget. And I listen to a lot of Greek cast, and some people forget, but most people know it to the day. So yesterday I looked up her obituary to check. I didn't even check in my own book. I looked up her obituary to check when she died. 7 years and 5 months ago.
That she died.
Wow. But I think I would probably have said it was 6 years and something. So it's weirdly not ingrained in me. If you'd asked me before she died, I would have said I would know to the hour. But yeah. I don't. I really don't. I get it wrong all the time.
That's so interesting. I don't think it's... As I said, my brother's the same. Like, I have to remind him. I'll be like, oh, it's the anniversary coming up. And he's like, is it? And I'm like... for years, I was like, how do you not know? How is it... burned onto your soul. But then I met other people who... I think it really depends on your relationship with dates and numbers, and I think some people just don't apply significance to dates in their, I don't know, in their like emotional world. Like, maybe other things aren't date-wise important to you, whereas to me, like, my birthday's important, like when I met someone's important. Like, I really have this like calendar in my head of things.
So I have to do a lot of reverse engineering to work out like how long I've been married or been with my partner or how old my sister is. It's all reverse engineering. So I suppose it's the same with mum.
Yeah. I did a really bad thing the other day. We had to put down when we got married. And I genuinely was like, oh yeah, no, it was the year after I did my first Edinburgh.
Easy.
And literally my husband was like, do you know how I remember it? And I said, no. And he went, it's the year that we got married. Like, oh God, the shame of a comedian. I felt so... not often I completely do a cliche like that. So it was 7 years ago.
Yes.
So that's an interesting time, 7 years, isn't it? Because you're kind of out of the initial like chaos rawness, but it's still quite recent, 7 years.
Yeah, it still feels very present,
yeah,
I think,
yeah.
But not raw. That probably is the difference. It was raw for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Although I've been surprised by quite how much it's affected me during lockdown. I feel like I've taken quite a few steps back through lockdown in terms of my grieving process.
But
it has suddenly felt newer.
Yeah. How has it affected... Let's talk about that because I think it's really interesting. How has it made you feel like you've gone backwards?
It's felt probably even more present than it does anyway. And I've just missed her a lot more. I miss her a lot. I mean, we'll get into the fact that me and mum were like creepily close, but even taking that into account, I've missed her a lot more. And I think it was probably around the time when, you know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks in, when people started talking about how much they missed their family. And it was that point where that very I think it's quite a unique feeling to a close bereavement of like sadness and frustration, anger that all crystallise into this point that just feels like it's going to burst out of you, and it can come at weird, unexpected times. And I just felt that frequently throughout that period where I was like, yeah, well, at least you've got a mum, at least you can do it. Those feelings that I felt very acutely for the first 2 years, 3 years of grief, but then have somehow mellowed or softened, they were back again with me feeling like everyone has it easier than me. It's incredibly hard. It felt just painful again, really painful.
I think that's a really common griefster experience through lockdown. I noticed that. I was tweeting about it as well, because I think, so one, your life is full of distractions. So if you are a bit further away from the death, like you said, you feel sad, but like, you know, you can get swept up in life a bit more, I think, the further you get away. So you'll have like work or family or friends and stuff. And then you'll be like, oh yeah, that is sad, they're not here. Whereas those first few years, it's all consuming.
Yeah.
And suddenly in lockdown, we had no distractions. And also I felt, the thing that really got me was like, and I had the same thing, you know, 20 plus years. And I was like, oh, I feel the grief is really present. Why have you shown up?
Yeah. Where have you come from?
Yeah, what the fuck do you want? I felt like when someone dies, you know, that feeling like you want the world to stop and you can't believe it's going on. And I felt like I'd look outside and be like, oh, it's like it did what I wanted. It's like it stopped. This is awful. I feel like everybody's that frozen feeling, which is quite griefy.
Yeah.
yeah, I really felt it very present and very strange. And yeah, I guess it's like you said, you're suddenly aware of the lack of things and the presence of things because it's so quiet. So I was very aware of things I was very grateful for. I was like, oh, I'm so grateful. Like, you know, we have a house and it's warm and there is food in the fridge. Like, we are so lucky. But then I was very aware of the lack of things that were missing, like, yeah, yes. family and stuff like that. So yeah, I think that's, it's such a, it was very, I hate that, I don't love this phrase, but it's very triggering, I think,
yeah,
for a griefer.
It really was, wasn't it? And I think I felt that, although I was similarly in a very lucky position, you know, we have a nice house and I have a partner and we have food in the fridge, it felt like life had stalled.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get to where I planned to. So there were work things that have fallen through, and we'd sort of had this plan that we would start looking more consciously to move out to London. And, you know, we might at some point want to start a family, which is also so bound up in grief and my mum as well.
Yeah,
all those things suddenly grinding to a halt and having no clear point at which they will restart again felt really difficult. And it felt like that moment when you're bereaved, when no one else's life stopped, but yours has, except everyone else's has. It's just that I'm very self-involved. but it is that moment of standing still when you don't want to be standing still, which is so similar to the early stages of grief.
Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, I completely relate. And I was surprised when it hit me. That's why I tweeted. I was like, is anyone else finding this a bit griefy? And so many people were like, oh my God, yes.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh yeah, okay. It's just, it's the weirdness. It's, I guess it's anything, you know, so traumatic, an experience we're all going through. It takes you back to your most traumatic experience.
Yeah.
So how did Ruth die? What happened?
So Mum had been ill for quite a while, but not in a way that meant that she should have died. So she'd had cryptogenic cirrhosis of the liver, which is cirrhosis of the liver that they can't point to a direct cause of it.
Okay.
So it wasn't, you know, because of alcohol consumption or anything like that, which is a typical reason for cirrhosis of the liver. She'd been very poorly with it for a while, and it would sort of go up and down, and she occasionally had to go into hospital for it. And it was quite stressful, and she was struggling with ill health. But I think we thought, okay, at some point in the distant future, she might need a liver transplant, and that will be really difficult. But she was not dying. And unbeknownst to us, she had, as a sort of a consequence of that cirrhosis, she had a stomach ulcer that was undiagnosed and bled out. And that was what actually killed her.
Oh my goodness.
So she, we were on the phone that morning and she told me that she was tired, I think. And I was like, who isn't tired? Everyone's tired all of the time. And we had like a perfectly normal conversation. And then that night she died.
And was, oh my God.
Yeah, I was found the next morning by my dad. So yeah, that was, I always think it's the worst of both worlds because I like to imagine that I do have it worse than anyone else. It was like a long illness that left her really miserable and poorly, but also incredibly sudden and no way of saying goodbye. So yeah, that was how she died.
I do think that's really harsh because like you said, I do, because I think you're right. You know, I talked, there's sort of two loose categories of grievers, and it is often there was a long illness, we had a chance and it came out of the blue. No one knew what the hell was going on. And so, yeah, I do really understand that. Although it said, you know, my dad had a shortish illness and still refused to talk about it.
Yes.
So you can get that fun middle ground. That must have been such a shock. So did you just get a phone call?
Yeah. So I was at, I lived in quite far north London at the time, but I was in Stockwell in South London.
As far south as you can get far north.
Yeah.
North Londoner, yeah.
I mean, it's all on the Victoria line, but I was still pretty far south at the time. And I'd stayed over the night before at the house of a man who at that point was not my boyfriend, but was possibly going to be a boyfriend at some point in the future.
Right, okay.
But it was very, very early days. So I'd stayed over at his house, and the next day we'd had friends over for dinner, and the next day we were just, you know, having a lazy Sunday. And then I had a voicemail from my dad. And I've always said, I hate my dad leaving voicemails because I'm always convinced it's going to be something awful. That anxiety extends far before Mum. And I went to the bathroom, sat down on the loo, listened to the voicemail. And I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was Dad effectively just saying, call me, something's happened. But I knew within that moment, what it was that had happened. And I called him, and he told me that Mum had died. And I was like, right, well, I have to get home. And home was Newcastle. So I had to go from Stockwell to Newcastle, not via my own home. So I was wearing like gold glittery heels at the time.
Oh my God.
And then, yeah, get a train ticket to Newcastle on a Sunday night. So the train was packed. And I remember sitting on the train next to this man, and I was crying. And I didn't really realise I was crying. I definitely thought I was being extremely subtle in my unhappiness. And he said, oh, you know, if you want to talk about it, we can talk about it. It's fine. And I just thought, I can't. Whatever this man thinks is wrong, it is not that I've just found out my mother's dead and I'm returning home to her. I cannot put this on this poor man.
Aww.
So yeah, I just sat there on the train to Newcastle having this like sort of out of body experience, crying. Not the best location to be in when you find out that a loved one's died.
Bless him for trying, but yeah, do you think he probably does it as like, oh, the boy hasn't called back,
exactly,
rather than like,
exactly.
No, it's not that.
My mother has literally just died.
Bless you.
Although I did
so
think at the
dense.
Time, this will be a good story in the future. So there was clearly, I was clearly rational enough at that point to be like, yeah, this is narratively nice if realistically rubbish.
That's a true writer. And every opportunity something happens, you're like, this is awful. But I mean, it is a good story,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
let's log this one for later.
Yeah, that is funny. So then you go back and I guess it just goes into that when someone's died, like sort of what's the word, like roller coaster things and admin and all of that.
So
is
much
that...
admin.
Yeah.
So much admin.
But you were very close to your mum then, so...
Yeah, really, really close. I it feels quite strange to talk about it now because it is quite a while ago and I've written about it a lot and I've talked about it a lot. So I feel slightly disconnected from it when I say we were incredibly close, but we were incredibly close. We would speak multiple times a day on the phone, and she was like, she was my best friend. Isn't that an awful cliche? But she was my best friend.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I know there's like a now running gag of like, if that, your mum's your best friend, like, get a life kind of thing. But like, because I'm also slightly in that club, I'm like, hey,
don't say such nasty things.
Leave us alone. We're just really good friends.
We were really close and we were really similar. We loved a lot of the same stuff. So it sounds like I'm sort of giving you a MySpace profile, but like we love books and we love theatre and we like the same TV shows and we thought in quite similar ways. And yeah, we were just really, really close. And that was, I mean, I hadn't lived at home for at that point 6 years, but we would just talk constantly. And she didn't text. She had a mobile phone that was constantly off in her handbag that she literally never used. So it was always me calling the home landline speaking on a phone call.
Old school.
Many times. I mean, I was an extraordinarily needy daughter. Like, I, looking back now, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was weird, Livvy. But at the time, it felt normal.
Yeah. People normalise. You normalise your life, don't you? Because you're like, this is fine. This is totally fine. Yeah. No one's saying it's weird, so I guess it's not weird. So then what happened? Did you have like a funeral to organise? Was it just kind of chaos?
So I went up to the family home and my sister had arrived home before I had. My dad was there and coincidentally, Mum's sister had been coming up to visit her that day. She was also there. And then my aunt and uncle on my dad's side came up. So suddenly, for quite a full house, all our grandparents had died by that point. So I don't think of us as being a very big family.
Yeah.
But all the family that did exist was suddenly there. And I basically went into admin mode and did a huge amount of the organising. And in a way that I thought at the time was very selfless and probably quite impressive. I hoped that people were impressed by me. And actually, looking back, I was probably a bit of a dick about it because I decided that this was going to be my role. I probably took it away a bit from my dad and sister, but I thought I was saving them.
It's such a mixed... Livvy, we sound quite similar. It's such a, like... That's our thing with hindsight, isn't it? You, in the moment, you can be like, I am being helpful. Look how helpful I am. Yeah. Why are you not thanking me? And then you don't realise like how suffocating that can be. And everyone's like, well, there's no room for us.
I'm sure I did it with like severe martyrdom as well. Yeah. Like, fine, fine, guys, it's okay. I'm going to do the eulogy. Don't worry about it. Don't even think about it. And maybe they wanted to. I mean, I don't think anyone does want to do the eulogy for their mother's wedding, but it's because I'm a wedding caterer. Mother's funeral. Funeral, we tend not to do eulogies at weddings.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of that, and I was working with the undertaker. although I say, I remember him calling me. So as all of this like admin stuff basically lasted a year and a half, 2 years. Right. It was just my way of being arrested in grief. So
of course.
I was like, I'm totally fine. This is obviously dreadful. I wasn't in denial about it. What's happened is awful, but I'm going to survive because my mum had some very weird ideas about grief and how one should publicly grieve. And the most important thing and the most true thing I could do to her would be to be unflappable about the whole thing and not melodramatic and no like public crying or anything like that. So the way in which I channeled that was to do all of the admin, and I went straight back to work. So I did 2 days at home, helped organise the funeral, went back down to London to go to work.
And you weren't a chef at this point, either?
No, I was a criminal barrister. Just to make things more complicated.
Yeah.
I was a criminal barrister. And I had a case that in my head I had to do. It was absolutely imperative. If I didn't do it, I was going to lose this major client. And it just didn't matter. But at the time, it really did. And I remember standing on the platform of a train taking me to Luton to go to the Crown Court. And the undertaker calling me to like check something about a song we were having at the crematorium, and then making jokes about the fact I was unmarried. He was like, oh, we need to get you married off. And I was like, how am I having this weird kind of like jokey relationship with an undertaker? I'm 24. My mother's dead. God. I've inexplicably forced myself back to work in Luton. What is going on?
Wow, but that's really...
I just created this persona, and the persona was like, girl who's good at grief. And we'll organise your funeral and come and do the eulogy and like smile at the wake and everything will be fine.
I think it's very understandable, and it sounds like you've obviously had hindsight on it as well, but it is understandable because it's just coping.
Yeah.
And there's a good episode of my podcast with the Mac twins, and their dad died very suddenly, and I thought it was so interesting that they just... one of them did what you're saying, admin, sort out everything, and the other one just played Candy Crush, was like, I cannot do this. And I think it's so common. You kind of have this, there's this, after someone dies, there's this quiet, and then everyone's like, right, what are you gonna do? And if someone steps up, it's like, I'm gonna do everything.
Yeah.
Then everyone's like, oh, well, then we're gonna sit and be sad because there's no room and you're doing everything. And then the person who's made that decision is like, why have I done this? Why? And I bet that undertaker just probably thought, oh, she's great. She's doing really well, coping really well. I bet all your friends were like, yeah, no, it's really sad, but she's doing really well, doing really good.
Like, yeah. Although I remember hearing my dad on the phone to someone, because dad and I had divvied up like all the people you have to tell. There are so many people you have to tell.
Yeah.
Like, you have to tell all the friends, but you also have to tell, like, I had to cancel a hairdresser's appointment.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I had to take her library books back and that sort of thing. I remember the hairdresser crying on the phone.
Oh,
I remember that really vividly. And I would phone these people up, and I sound exactly like mum. So I would phone up and they'd go, oh my God, Ruth, how are you? And I'd be like, well, it's not Ruth. And funny story.
Wait for it. Wait for the punchline. You're not going to believe it.
Yeah. Oh, so my I did God. That over and over again. But I remember hearing dad on the phone talking to someone who he'd broken the news to. And they clearly said, my sister's called Madeline, how Olivia and Madeline. And dad said, yeah, they're doing quite well. Like, Olivia's kind of doing too well. And I remember really vividly the feeling of like, how dare you suggest that this is not real? But also pride that it had been recognised that I was just superlative at losing my mum.
Yeah.
And it took so, so long for me to unscramble this. And I was living with two friends in London at the time. And I've talked to one of them, I'm still very, very close to. Talked to one of them since. And she said, I was so worried about you. But I also knew you. And I knew if I sort of confronted you on it and said, you are not coping, although you think you are coping, you'd just close down. So I kind of just had to let you continue in this way. But I was so worried the whole time. And I'd never even thought about that. Like, it never occurred to me that Susie would have found it hard.
I think that's really, really interesting. And I think that sounds like your friend is amazing.
They were pretty good. I mean, when I first came home from being up north, I'm not very tidy. Like, I'm better now. My husband's made me a bit better. They tidied my room, done all my washing, folded my clothes, put it on the bed, and stocked the fridge with all my favourite things, and then just kind of let me talk about it if I wanted to, but didn't push it. It was one of the kindest things that's ever been done to me, coming back to that flat in Crouch End, and they'd clearly thought, what can we do practically that's going to help
her? It's so small, isn't it? And it's the kind of thing I think sometimes people think, oh, that won't make a difference. You're like, no, it does.
It really
does. The tiny things do. But I think that's so interesting that she knew you well enough.
Yeah.
Because I think we've all, you know, oh, God, we're quite similar. I've definitely had that where I'm like, I'm in control. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Why are people looking at me weirdly? I don't know. I'm coping so well. Look at me coping. And then, like, you know, 2 months later, my husband's like, yeah, I know. Of course I knew.
Yeah.
I'm like, why didn't you say anything? And he's like, if I could have said anything, you would have gone worse.
Yeah.
So
no,
you have
exactly.
to like, just like kind of, it's like a toddler, isn't it? You have to like walk near them in case they fall over, but you can't like take no. over. You're like, okay, I'm here if you fall. I'm very aware you're about to, but I'm not, you think you're in control.
Cause yeah.
What I think, especially when a death like yours, when it's so sudden and so you're so out of control, you're scrabbling to pull your world back together, aren't you? So
yeah.
you're trying to like, of course, admin and emails and telling people makes you feel like, okay, the world is controllable. I can
yeah.
do this.
And I live my life by like a to-do list. That's always yeah. been the way I've done it. And I just turned grief into another to-do list, I
yeah.
think. And I was, you know, I was doing the eulogy, so I had that to write. And I was executor on her estate, so I could deal with all the legal stuff. And that was great because I was a lawyer.
Yeah.
So I was, my sister wasn't, so I took over that as well. I eventually went to therapy quite a while later, but it wasn't until I was writing the book. I was about halfway through writing the book when I went to therapy. And I kept trying to berate myself in therapy sessions where I was like, I've caused this arrested grief. Like mm-hmm. I have almost deliberately repressed it. And it has like ossified inside me until it's something that I can't cope with. And my therapist was like, your brain was just protecting you. Like you were mm-hmm. not in a position to deal with the loss at that stage. Clearly, you would have just fallen apart and your brain knew better than you did and was like, fine, we just won't deal with it yet. And it was like the sun rising when he said that actually I hadn't just destroyed, I don't know, 4 or 5 years of my life by being overly efficient and a bit of a dickhead. Like it was, that there was good
like,
reason for it.
Are you like generally very hard on yourself?
What on earth would make you say that? Yeah, a little bit.
God, yeah, I hear you. Because I think, yeah, like, I mean, look, I'm 20 plus years. That's why I can, I just say 20 plus these days, can't be bothered to narrow it down. 22. And I completely understand, like, it sounds like as well, I hate to psychoanalyze because I'm not trained, but if you are a bit of a perfectionist and you like things done in a good way. It sounded like it wasn't like you were pressing, you were trying to do grief really well.
Yeah.
You were trying to do it well. And the problem with grief is it's so fucking messy.
Yeah.
It's so okay.
And the prospect of that chaos, because it is chaos.
Yeah.
Like it's so,
chaos.
So messy. And the prospect of that was just so overwhelming. Mm. And I think I felt constantly if I gave into that, I would never come out of it, which is not the case. But that was definitely how it felt at the time,
yes.
that I cannot fall into this abyss of grief,
mm.
because if I do, I will stop working, I will stop getting up in the mornings, I
yeah.
will just lose my mind.
That's exactly what I had in therapy, because I was like, oh, I can only talk about it, you know, I would talk about it, but I was like, I can only talk about it so much
mm.
in my control, and there's stories I will share.
Yeah.
And then there was this whole murky world of other things that just did not get discussed. And I remember her saying, she was like, what do you think is going to happen? I was like, I think I will start crying and I will never stop.
Yeah.
Like that's in my head. And
yeah,
she's like,
yeah.
She's like, but nobody's ever done that. You know, no one has ever just continually. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess. But in my head, I was like, I know me best.
Yeah,
like,
no, I had exactly the same. And
yeah.
I mean, I know it's jumping ahead a bit with the therapy stuff. So
no,
the first thing to say is that I sort of initially went for therapy in the aftermath of the death.
Right.
And was referred to CBT, which just doesn't work for me. So I saw a psychiatrist
yeah.
who was like, you shouldn't do CBT because you What was it he said? Because I took it as a huge compliment and it definitely wasn't. I think he was like, you'll over-intellectualise it. And I was like, thank you. That's not what I meant.
I got sent CBT as well. And I think I found CBT very, like a plaster, like very helpful to get through the next few weeks. But then I was like, no, this shit is, I need more than this.
My problem was that my anxiety had predated Mum's death. And it had always been focused on someone I love dying. And I had this whole thing where, like, someone I love is going to die. And then they did. And I was like, see, CBT, the whole point with CBT is you learn these mechanisms for the fact that your thought processes are probably wrong. And you need to, like, tone them down. And I was like, I think you'll find that actually...
That's exactly how I felt. I was like, she would say to me, you know, you had this anxiety, like, why do you think you're going to, why is this coming from? And I was like, because someone died.
Yeah. And then she was like, I was right. Anxiety was right. The world was wrong.
And she would go, yes, but lots of people didn't die. I was like, yes, but one of them did. Yeah. So it's
and they actually meant quite a lot to me.
Yeah. It's all very well being like, she was like, yeah, but, you know, on your average day, people aren't dying. And I was like, yes, but the one time it really mattered, they did. So I'm afraid my brain is like, whenever you're arguing, like, hey, you know, don't be anxious, come on. The world, you're like, boom, like trump card.
Yeah, exactly.
There it is.
Exactly.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
I stopped doing that therapy. And also at that point, I was very unhappy with my job and I was trying to sort of work that out. So that therapy went quite badly. And I used to be given homework for it because they give you homework with CBT often.
Yeah.
And they like make you fill in little forms. And I just wouldn't do it. And I would sit on the tube on my way to do it, like trying to second guess what the right answers were supposed to be, like what makes it look like I'm processing this properly.
So I
do all of that. It was just hopeless. And it wasn't until I was writing the book that I went back. He made me sit with my feelings because I had exactly the same thing. I was like, I don't want to cry about this. And I would tell my stories and be like, I hope he's going to find me funny and charming, which I understand is a common therapy trope. And they don't. They literally never do. They think you're an idiot who can't process their own feelings. So people like, your thoughts were like everything you're doing is above your head and we need to bring it back down. You need to feel it. And I was like, oh, no. What you've misunderstood here is that I might want to feel any of this stuff. Like I've worked very hard to not feel it. And he was like, yeah, but you're also deeply unhappy and you have found a point in your life where you want to engage in a way that deals with this grief. You're going to have to sit with it. And he used to basically... This makes him sound like more of a dick than he is. He was very, very good. He used to goad me into crying. He used to deliberately get me to talk about things that he knew would make me cry because he knew that that was like my final defense.
Yeah.
And I hated it. Like I hated it so much. And then I sort of reached this point where I was like, oh my God, he's fixing me. Like it was week after week where I was like, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. This is dreadful. And then I started processing stuff. But I had spent a full, 5-6 years working very hard to actively repress any time the thought of mum or sadness came up, it felt like I was physically pushing it down inside me.
Yeah.
And I got to a point where I knew that wasn't healthy, but then that's the only way you know how to deal with it.
Yeah, and I think also, to be fair to yourself, like 24 is really young. It's really young. It's massively young. And I think, you know, most 24-year-olds aren't facing their own mortality, their parents' mortality. What does life mean? Who am I? Where did I come? Like all of that stuff that a death like literally drops a bomb into your life. I think that's so common. And I think it's very common. It's noticed a lot with teenagers who are bereaved is that they don't really do any therapy till they hit 30s. Because it's like, you're a teenager, what the hell's just happened? And you spend your 20s repressing, trying to deal what the hell just happened to me. And then by about 30, you're like, oh, I'm not happy. Oh, it's because of that. But I think, like you said, your brain does what it needs to do to keep you living. And that's fine.
Although it's interesting that you said, so a sort of crucial part of the story is that mum's dad died when she was 12. And she never dealt with it.
Right.
And had these very, as I say, these very sort of unique ideas about how one should grieve and what's appropriate and what's not. And some of it was just her being a snob, frankly. But clearly some of it was based on the way in which she'd lost her father and the hurt that she'd felt through that and the fact that she'd never really dealt with it. And I think that that played such a huge part in the way that, in my relationship with her, but also in then the way that I grieved for her, because it did feel like I was trying to measure myself up to her ways of grieving, I think, as well. But she should definitely have had therapy in her 30s, and she would probably be a much happier person for it. But she didn't.
For that generation as well. Yeah. So, you know, so did her dad die quite suddenly? Or was
he had lung cancer.
And it was not really discussed, I'm guessing.
No. Yeah. And her mum remarried within a year, I think. Mum and her stepfather never really got on.
Yeah.
But her elder sister, who has also since died, everyone's dead. She died just before my wedding, which was tricky. But anyway, her elder sister was away at boarding school and then left home. So it was just my mum, her mum, and her new stepfather at home. And I think she found that very, very difficult. And she had, like, she actually had quite a close relationship to Peter in the end, because as my grandparents got older, I mean, he was the only grandfather I knew from that side, so he was still my grandpa. But as they got older, mum took on a lot of the caring roles. So she was sort of quite close to him, but their relationship was always difficult. And I'm sure that it was made more difficult by the fact that it was pretty soon after he died.
God.
And they had the same name, which I probably doesn't screw you up if you call your father dad. But to me, I find that, like,
that is really weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
That thing, that's really interesting, that you do learn so much from your parents. And of course, if your mum had, you know, to lose a dad at 12 will affect you for the rest of your life. And then you trying to, like you said, measure yourself up to like how she had grieved and what she would have done if she was grieving herself almost. It's like,
we talked about him quite a lot, but yet I feel like I know nothing about him, which is really weird. Like, we always knew that mum's dad had died. We always knew that she loved him loads and she missed him. And I know he was a civil engineer, and I think he might have played the ukulele. That's it. That's what I know. And I find that so strange that this person that meant so much to her and that was a presence in our lives was clearly talked about in quite a delineated way.
It sounds like very protected as well. Yeah. So she obviously didn't want to open that box in case she started crying and couldn't stop.
Yeah,
so she was like,
that.
I'm sad. Which, if even you to know that, is quite an intellectual thing, isn't it? Like, oh, I am sad about this.
Yes.
He was a civil engineer, but I'm not telling you how it felt at the time or what. All of that. Yeah. I think, God, that's so... Parents. Like, so interesting, isn't it? Because I always think you need to go one generation back to go, oh, and then you need to go another two back to be like, oh, I see. To like, that's why they were like that. And that's why they did that. Like, it's really... And that's so interesting how it affected your grief. So you said, when did you start writing the book then? Years after that?
Oh, goodness. So I started blogging first.
Right,
I started. So to go back a little bit, the way that I dealt with grief in any meaningful sense, because I didn't really deal with it, was I started baking.
Right.
So prior to mum's death, I couldn't cook or bake at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I lived on like supermarket tortellini and takeaway kebabs and supermarket sauces that went on the tortellini, and like that was it. I really, really couldn't cook. But there was something about baking that felt very grounding, and it kind of took me out of my own head. My job was quite intellectual. Grief, it makes you think a lot. And physically using my hands to make stuff and following a recipe and having to pay attention was quite soothing. Although I didn't see any of that at the time, but that, looking back, that was clearly the case. So I became quite obsessive, unsurprisingly, about baking, and just kept going and going and going. And the guy whose room I'd been in when I found out that my mum had died had by that point become my boyfriend. And he said, why don't you write about the intersection between the active baking and grieving? So I started a blog, which was a half-baked idea. And the first recipe was, or the first blog post was, when life gives you lemons, make lemon curd. And it was just like a little bit of stuff about mum, a little bit of stuff about food, here's a recipe. And it was a very small time blog. There were not a lot of people reading it, but it kind of allowed me to, having previously only written in a like a legal way, it allowed me to find my voice and to like exercise those writing muscles. And one of the few people who was reading it became my agent. And she took me out for a coffee and said, have you thought about writing a book? And I was like, well, yeah, because like, who hasn't thought about writing a book?
Yeah, yeah.
But also, no, not in any meaningful sitting down and writing many, many words in quick succession way of writing a book. So the original plan had been for me to write the whole thing and then we'd send it out on proposal. Turns out I can't do anything without a deadline.
So. Mate, I hear you. I really hear you. I can't just do it because I want to. Someone has to tell me I'll be in trouble. I'll do it.
You know when people say like, oh, if no one ever read my work again, I just keep writing because I love it. So absolutely not. Would watch Netflix and I would eat crisps. Like, I need to know that it's going somewhere and to have a deadline and to feel anxious about it, essentially.
Yes.
So we kind of put a false deadline in place and I wrote a proposal. And that sold in July 2018.
Okay.
May 2018? I was on honeymoon, that's it. It was May 2018. I found out that I got the book deal in a graveyard, which felt appropriate.
Perfect.
But so I started writing it properly in May 2018 and it was due December 2018. So in terms of book writing, it's quite a quick turnaround. And halfway through that, I realised I needed to go to therapy fairly urgently, which was the best thing I've ever done.
So is the process of writing just made you go, I actually can't handle sitting in it? Because the thing with writing about grief, you really have to sit in it.
You really have
Tell
to sit in it.
Tell me about it. It is you not really comfortable.
It is really rubbish. And I found that really, really hard. And I remember talking to my agent, who is brilliant and incredibly like sensitive about the fact that I'm writing about my dead mum. But I remember her saying to me, it must be quite cathartic writing all of this. And I was like, no. What is the opposite of catharsis? Like, it's like plugging salt into a very open wound.
Yeah. It's like getting a spatula covered in salt.
Yeah.
And digging it right
really
in.
Really going in there.
Can that wound get bigger?
Yeah.
I don't know. How much can we get to bone? What's under there? Like, that's what it feels like. Because I'm in the middle of writing at the moment. And I find as well, you write it. Writing the first bit, it's like, bleh, fine.
Yeah.
You have to fucking read this shit.
Oh,
you have to read it.
Bet you're doing your own audiobook. Are you doing your own audiobook?
Yes, of
course.
It's
like, I had such a nice director and producer, so the whole thing was lovely. It's the worst. Because you then have to read out all these like incredibly like vulnerable
personal
things. And I got through so much of it without crying. I got through like, I don't know, 7/8 of it without crying.
Wow.
And then just lost it. It's like, I can't do this. And actually, the reason I lost it was because what really affected me when I was writing the book was that mum's sister had died fairly recently.
Right, yeah.
And I loved my Auntie Jan a lot, but not to the extent that I expected to be that broken by her death. I found it because I'd started like thinking about grief, like I was reading up on it, I was reading all the grief books, listening to all the back episodes of Griefcast. You know, I was really immersed in grief when she died. And it was almost like re-grieving mum.
Mm.
I found that really, really hard.
I think sometimes there's a really weird thing. And I don't know how to describe it, because it sometimes sounds like not doing justice to that person dying. But sometimes I hear of some deaths who people I know, and I'm like, oh, that's sad. Oh, dear. That's awful, obviously. And then other people, you're like, ow, why is this... like you said, it seems to trigger so much in you of the first death that got you. And I don't know, like, because that first death that like opens up your heart and makes you go, oh, I see, we all die, nothing's safe. That first realization. And it's what I find weird is it's not like, I had a friend whose mum passed away recently of like the same cancer that my dad had. And I was very sad, but I didn't feel broken by it. Like, I was just like, oh, that's awful. I was there for her and I was texting her and calling her, but I didn't feel like it got under my skin in the way that recently a friend died very suddenly. And I was like you said, broken, just like, whoa, smacked across the face. And it just depends on all little tiny things. Like,
it's really strange. And sometimes it's people I don't know. Like, I really struggled with Victoria Wood's death and Linda Bellingham's death, because we had like, they're not even interesting stories to tell you, but we had like little in-jokes in the family or like connections with them that made me, they were so inextricably linked to mum and also quite a similar age that I found that hard. But I think with Jan, part of it, Jan was my mum's sister, part of it was that she had very aggressive stomach cancer. So she was diagnosed in September and died in November, I think I got that right.
Wow, that's really fast.
Really, really aggressive. And but we all got to say goodbye. And that was something that I'd obviously lacked with mum. And I didn't want to do it. I really, really didn't want to do it. And when my dad phoned me and said, Jan's in this hospital, I think you should go and see it. And I was like, well, I'm very busy. I don't know if you know, I'm writing a book about grief. I'm quite busy at the moment.
I couldn't possibly see somebody's dying. How awful. I'm busy writing about death. Yeah. Please leave me alone. God,
And I was like, well, we've got a wedding in Scotland at the weekend, but I'll try and get there after that. And Dad was like, no, you need to go. So I did. And I remember viscerally sitting in the waiting room, because a doctor was seeing her when I first arrived. So I was put into a waiting room and shaking. Really shaking. I'd been given a glass of water and my hand was just going, and I was so nervous about the whole thing. And then actually it was kind of lovely, because I hadn't seen her for a while and I loved her so much. And I, apart from my sister, there's no one else in the world who loved mum in the same way that me and Madeline did. Like, Jan was so close to her. And in fact, when mum died, I found Jan's grief really difficult, because she was much more open about it than me and my sister, and dealt with it in a much healthier way. I remember her saying that we'd given her a perfume of mum's, and she was like, in the morning, I open the perfume and I smell it and I sit at my dressing table and I think of Ruth for like 20, 30 minutes, and then I put the lid back on and I go about my day. And I was like, oh my God, like, so earnest, so sentimental. Mum would hate it. And she would have hated it, actually. But it was a much, much healthier way to deal with it. But at the time I was like, Jan, this is, you are sort of suggesting that your grief is comparable to mine and my sister's. And I think now, if I lost my sister, like, I get it. I totally get it. But at the time I was so blinkered. So sitting down with Jan and talking about mum in a really quiet and meaningful way, just the two of us in this really like kind of momentous setting, was really wonderful. But it was so hard, because it just re-articulated that I'd never had that with mum.
It's so hard, isn't it? I think the older I get and the more grief stuff I read and think about, I think it's about holding those two things.
Yeah.
It is so sad you didn't get that with your mum. It is so great you had that with her.
Right.
And they both exist. They don't cancel each other out.
No.
But of course, there will always be that deep, deep well of sadness that you didn't get to chat to your mum in that way. But then if you hadn't, you wouldn't have spoken to Jan like that if you hadn't have missed that. You know what I mean? Everything is so linked and connected. It was because of the death of your mum that you were able to sit and go, even though every bone in my body wants to run away from this hospital, I am going in there. Yeah, I've had that when you just like, my feet are literally
moving because they're going run yeah. run away don't go in, don't talk to this person, don't do it, and your brain is like, I think I have to, but your body's like, no, we don't like it, we don't feel safe, just get out of here. Yeah. You're like, what am I gonna do, run into the car park and run home and never speak to anyone again? Like, you have to do these things. But I think that's, and it's interesting as well what you said about blinkered. Tom Price's episode, he said something about that, which I remember at the time thinking he was a bit harsh, but he was like, people who are grieving could be like real idiots, real twats. And I was like, ow. But it does blinker you so much. And of course a sister's grief is deeply painful. But when, I do think when it's a parent, you don't understand. And also when you're young, I think that's the other thing. I found that, I remember his friends crying and I was like, God, why are they crying? Yeah. Like, it's not your dad. It didn't occur to me that they would be missing that. They'd lost someone, yeah. Because I was like, but I lost my dad. So why are you upset?
It still feels a bit like this to me, that there is, although I know rationally it's wrong, I'll just put that in there, like I'm not insane. It feels like there's a finite amount of grief and that people are invading your grief. If they are not just feeling overwhelming sympathy for you, although I didn't want that, like I would have rejected that. But I would like to have known that they were feeling that whilst not like suggesting that they understood my loss. Mm. And that is bonkers and obviously nonsense, but it's the only way that I felt at the time. Like, this is mine, it's all mine.
And it's interesting,
I felt very possessive about it.
But I guess also, if you're not able, just literally not able to feel the grief because of it's so overwhelming, you are almost putting in a box for safekeeping. So then when somebody does feel it, you're like, oh, well, no, I'm coming back to that.
I
haven't done with it. Don't touch it because... It's still mine. Because what you don't realise is if you just let it out, it will come, it will go. It will, some days it will be there, some days it won't. Like, that's why I think, like you said, the rawness that happens, I would say, like, years 1 to 5.
Yeah.
As you get past that, you realise, like, oh, it's just going to be here. Like, it's just part of this. This is what I am now. But I completely understand that, like, possessive nature of it. And also, I think because it was so sudden for you and you didn't get that chance, so you're constantly having to like process what just happened. Like,
and it just felt so viscerally unfair. I had this thing I talk about in my book, which is also me being mad, but is grief top trumps. It's really important. It's really important that I have suffered more than anyone else. And obviously I know that's not true, and that is mad, but that was how I felt at the time. And I, like, grief top trumps was always skewed towards me, obviously. So if you know, say your parent had had a very long stretch of horrible cancer, which is to me unimaginable, like I've never experienced it, and I think it must be incredibly painful, but I would trump that because mine was sudden and I didn't get to say goodbye.
Yeah.
And you know, if it happened to you when you were younger than me, well, you probably weren't as close as I was to my mum. But if it happened to you when you were older, well, you'd had longer. If there was no way of in my head of beating me, of having a harder time. And I used to do these calculations constantly. And like with people that I knew from school who I hadn't seen for 15 years, with friends from uni, with like fictional characters, with celebrities, I'd be like, yeah, but I've got it worst. My grief is the worst and you can't touch it. And I was like, I kind of lost my mind about what grief and loss meant. Because I, for a long time, couldn't, this makes me a horrible person, but I couldn't understand how people could grieve grandparents.
I don't think it makes it horrible, but I was like that at the beginning as well.
Took me a long time. They're so old, they've had a whole life. You know, they saw you get married, they saw this, they got to hold their grandchildren, see them grow up, and like, my mum will never have that. And I, more importantly, I will never have my mum having that.
Yeah, yeah.
And for a long, long time, if people were like really thrown by a bereavement that wasn't a really close bereavement, I was at least inwardly rolling my eyes. And it took me so long. And I know, because you always say on Griefcast, you're like, you know, it doesn't matter what the closeness is, it doesn't matter what the relationship is.
There's no grief hierarchy.
There's no grief. Grief top trumps is the opposite of that. I would listen to the episodes and be like, rationally, I see that. But also, and it took me a very, very long time. And the impulse is still there for me to go, nah, it's not a good thing. But I'm getting better.
No, I think that's really good to be honest about, because I think we all do it. And the reason I often say there's no grief hierarchy is to give myself a little hit around the head of like, Cariad, because I was deaf and I would have 100% been like that 7 years in. Like, what really changed for me was when my husband, well, my husband lost his father. I was, we weren't married then, but that for me was like, oh, well, I know that world. And then he lost his mum. And I was like, oh, yeah. I've always thought I had it very hard. Oh, this is... And when you get to see... When you're not the one grieving, but you're very close to the griever, and you're reversed, especially when you've been number one griever, I'm the one who's had it happen to me. I really took me out myself and made me go, oh, fuck, like, it is hard wherever you are, where you're standing. Even if you're standing close, obviously it's more painful. If you're standing next to that person, it's equally very painful because the person you love is in pain.
Yeah.
And that was a really good leveler for me because I was like, oh, I really thought I understood it and I didn't.
Yeah.
And then when I started doing griefcasts, and you would just hear these people's stories and you'd be like, oh, that sounds really sad. Like, but I totally, that impulse, I think, comes from the pain of missing someone and still wanting to say, I'm still upset about it.
Yeah, I'm not over it.
But you don't feel justified in that. So you go, well, it's because it happened to me very young. It's actually, poor me, it was very young. And instead of just going, oh, yeah, it was 20 years ago, but I'm still quite upset about it.
Yeah.
That's okay. Like, but you feel embarrassed and there should be a justification for your sadness.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite intellectualizing, isn't it? It's like, I can't just feel it.
No.
I have to
do actual calculations.
Actual maths. I mean, there's the barrister in you, isn't it? Like, what's the evidence that I win this case?
Exactly.
I've weighed it up. So you're 7 years now and the book has come out.
Yeah.
And you've completely changed your life.
Yeah.
You're not a barrister. You're now a very successful cook and writer of cooking things. food writer, that's the word I was looking for. Like, do you ever have a moment where you think, I probably do, like that duality of like, oh, my life is, I'm much happier, but did that happen because of this upheaval?
All the time.
Yeah.
Like, and I think actually the Fortnum and Mason Award came out during lockdown. And I think that also really played into why I found my grief so ramped up during lockdown. Because I am in almost every way, apart from one crucial way, much, much happier now. I mean, the guy that I was, I mean, it's not a spoiler, it's on the back of the book, like the guy that I was dating became my husband, and I'd literally been seeing him for like a week and a half, 2 weeks when mum died.
Wow.
I was a really, really unhappy criminal barrister. I'm not doing that anymore. As a consequence of like a small amount of inheritance, I was able to go and train at Le Cordon Bleu in patisserie, which I wouldn't have done otherwise. I wouldn't have discovered the love of cooking. I wouldn't have had this thing to write about in the same way.
Mm.
Like, everything that makes me happy today comes from the fact that mum has died.
Mm.
And that is overwhelming. And I find that quite difficult to process. And it goes hand in hand with the fact that the only person that I want to tell about any of it is her.
Mm.
And the person who would be proudest would absolutely, I mean, my dad's really proud, but like, mum wanted to be a writer and she wanted one of her kids to be a writer. And now, I mean, Madeline writes as well, but she would have just been so proud. And it took me a while even to look that in the eye. For a long time, I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, maybe she would be. Who knows? I can't say. And now I'm like, yeah, obviously she would be incredibly proud. But that is often too hard for me to look at directly.
Yeah,
it's too difficult.
It's really difficult. And Robert Webb spoke about it, and Felix White as well, was like, whenever something great happens, there's just this, I don't know, it's like this presence in the room, isn't it? Of like, oh, wow. Oh, yeah, they're not here. And it's just, even if it's fleeting, it's always there. And I feel like if you're not in the club, people think, oh my God, how depressing. But you're like, no, it's not depressing. It's just how it is.
Yeah. Although I think I find it very hard to celebrate things now, which is a bit depressing. Mm. I've talked to Sam about this a bit during lockdown, because we've like the paperback was published in lockdown. It was the Fortnums, and there was also the Guild of Food Writers Awards. And they were all like objectively brilliant things. And I was thrilled.
Mm.
But the moment it came to actually celebrating any of them, I kind of closed down and I was like, I'm not sure I really want to, because none of it was what I wanted, which was mum's approval.
Yeah.
Which actually I think is probably, even if she'd been alive, it's probably not super healthy to do everything for your mother's approval. And that was something that my therapist may have suggested. But
Yeah, all right, we'll take it in stages.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, give me chances. Let me get over grief.
Yeah, before you start unpicking our unhealthy relationship. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I found celebrating quite hard. Although we'd managed it quite well at the wedding. That was always, from the moment she died, I was like, I can't believe if I ever get married, she's not going to be there. And she would have been a nightmare. Like, she would have disagreed with almost every decision I made.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have agreed with the fact that, you know, we didn't announce into the newspaper. I didn't take my husband's name. But she would have loved it. And the fact that she wasn't there was so difficult. But then we had lots of different speeches, and she was in all of them. She was so present. We had, like, my dad spoke about her, obviously. My sister was my maid of honour, and she did, like, the most incredible speech that made the whole room cry, and spoke about her. I spoke about her, and Sam spoke about her. And I very much feel like the reason that we celebrated so well on that wedding day is because she was a part of it. And I don't, I can't bring myself to believe in the whole she's up there looking down on me thing. I don't believe in afterlife. I'm not religious. But she was a part of it, in the sense that the people who loved her made her a part of it, and her memory was there in a not maudlin way, but in a celebratory way.
So we are coming to the end. I can't recommend your book enough. It's a beautiful book. And I would like to heartily recommend, which kept me going through lockdown, your cookie recipe.
Oh, please. Thank you.
You're on Instagram, aren't you? So people can find the recipes on there. Like, because I think you're right, this idea of baking and creating in a process of grief is unbelievably healing, and very satisfyingly healing. But your cookie recipe was
thank you. Yeah, no, I've eaten a lot of those during lockdown.
Well, Olivia, thank you so much for coming to talk to me
about Ruth. Thank you for having me.
And your book. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You can follow Olivia on Twitter at _poots, POOTS _ for Twitter, and she's at A Half Baked Idea on Instagram. Her book, A Half Baked Idea, just came out in paperback. I thoroughly recommend it. She is a wonderful human and a brilliant writer. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. It was recorded in my living room and Olivia's living room. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. Artwork is by Jade Perkin. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.